It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Okay, we're on topic.
Completely ignore me.
Yeah. So just your full name first for the tape.
Padraic Byrne.
And your brother was?
Francis Byrne.
Francis Byrne. So you're in record, Joe.
From the news team at Virgin Media Ireland, this is Room 631, Ireland's COVID crisis. I'm reporter Zara King. This six-part podcast series contains the unheard tapes from the Virgin Media News documentary team. These episodes come from hours of footage taken during the making of our documentary, Ireland Under Lockdown. Throughout the series, we'll hear the thoughts of key decision makers who sat inside the walls of Room 631 at the Department of Health, and the voices of the people whose lives were changed by those decisions as a global crisis unfolded in their homes.
I just wanted to see him.
Okay. So, Padraic, I suppose to start at the very beginning, we first became familiar with you when we saw the photograph, now famous photograph, of you peering in the window of St. Luke's Hospital. Can you take us back to that moment? How did you end up there standing on that bench, and what was happening?
Yeah. Well, Francis was very sick at the time, and we knew there wasn't much time left. So the family were sent for. That's Francis's wife, Betty, and the daughter was sent for. And in the meantime, when this was all going on, my wife rang me to tell me that Francis has just passed away. And I said, did Betty and Rachel make it there? And they said, yeah, they're in the room with Francis. And I said, thank God for that. Because we knew it could be any time. And because of the COVID, people couldn't be in the room for hours or anything like that. So my wife was working in Luke's Hospital at the time, and I was the collector that evening. And I said, I'll go down to the hospital. And when I got to the hospital, Luke's Hospital there in Rackar, Felicity said, they're in the room with Francis. And I said, is there any way I can get in or anything like that? I knew myself that I couldn't. And I just looked, and I seen the bench. I knew which room Francis was in. I was outside on the lawn, and I said, I think I'm going to lift that bench, because I just wanted to see him. I hadn't seen my brother because of the COVID restrictions. I hadn't seen him in over 3 weeks. None of the family had seen him, and yet we were wearing him day and night all the time. So I got the bench, and I was able to lift it. It was light enough, and I put it up against the window, and we rang Betty to lift the curtains up. I said, pull the curtains up, I want to have a look. So it was a lovely spring evening, April evening, and the sun was shining. So I had to put my hands up against the window frame to look in, and I could see Francis. And I was just, even though it was so sad, I was happy myself that I could see him. And I felt terrible sorry for Betty and Rachel just in the room on their own. I would have loved them just to be in there. So that, in a way, that bench gave me the chance to see my brother.
And how did you feel when you saw him?
It was very hard to really put into words, because he, I was looking through a glass. I couldn't touch him. I couldn't hug him. And yeah, his wife and daughter were in there. They couldn't do the same. And it's just to want to hold your brother and say a last goodbye to him. It was terrible not having that connection.
And it's that bond between brothers is particularly strong, isn't it?
It is, yeah, because when my first brother died, Cormac, we carried him into the church. And I always remember one of my brothers tipped me on the shoulder, Brendan, and he said, this is the last time six of us will carry one of us in. And little did I know that we were never going to carry Francis in. And that was sad. Like, it's a brotherly thing to do, and that wasn't to be.
It was taken away from you.
It was taken away from us. The COVID took that away from us, yeah. Took that away. It took that bond, that connection. We were robbed of that. We were robbed of the grief for Francis. That connection and everything like that. And you'll never get that back. It's not going to come back. It was hard to kind of understand this. Why am I here? Why am I not in the room? You know, why is all this happening? It was like a darkness coming over us all. But yet, at the end of the day, the sun shone through the window and there was a light in there. And I was, you know, I was happy for that, that the room wasn't dark.
And that was the last time you saw him?
Pardon?
Was that the last time you saw him?
That was the last time I saw Francis. And that was, he had passed away at that stage. That's the last time I saw him.
So the next stage is then in terms of organising a funeral and trying to give him a send-off and say your goodbyes was obviously very challenging under the circumstances as well. Tell us about that.
Well, there was no funeral. And that's what we all knew when this was happening, that we all knew there was going to be no funeral. Such the restrictions were. I mean, when Francis passed away, like the sheets Francis was in were just folded over, and Francis would have been placed into a body bag. That's the reality of it. Because the less interfering with the patients or touching clothes or bed linen or anything like that, that's like there was no clothes sent in for Francis. Francis wasn't laid out in his clothes.
So, and you had said that, like, so basically it was a case of, like, everything was wrapped up and put into a closed casket and that was it. It was a very...
That was it. Francis would have been collected probably maybe that evening to go to the undertakers or the next morning to go to the graveyard.
How do you feel about that?
It's very sad. It's hard to comprehend, and yeah, it was happening, and we'd no power over. We couldn't do nothing about this at all.
And even since all of this has happened, and you reflect over it now, a couple of months later, do you still feel the same? Or are you angry now? Are you frustrated by it?
No, I wouldn't say I'm angry, because there's so many people have gone through this. I mean, if everyone was to be angry, I think we'd be in a worse place, in a worse place. But just going back to the funeral, like when Francis left the undertakers, he was brought home to where he lived, and he was outside his house, we say, for about 10 minutes, and all the neighbours came out and applauded. It was lovely. They showed Francis great respect. It was great. And when we got to the graveyard, we were all going over cars. And you must remember, this time there was only 10 people. There was 5 brothers, Francis' wife and daughter, and 3 other people. Only 10 people. And when we followed the cortege up to where Francis' grave was, we were stopped. And then the cortege moved on ahead, and Francis was taken out and lowered into the grave. We weren't even at the gravesite when that was happening. We weren't at the gravesite when that happened. And then when Francis was lowered in, then we were called forward. We were just a short distance away, but still that connection wasn't there. It was taken from us. We couldn't be at the grave when Francis was being lowered in or anything like that.
That was so tough.
And the priest said a few prayers, and That was the end of it. We couldn't hug Betty or Rachel. Like, it was just very strange. Like, nobody. Like, sometimes you'd see a graveyard, at the grave, people would be hugging each other, embracing each other, crying. You'd hear the scream sometimes. And there was nothing like that. There was a complete silence.
So Rachel Byrne.
Rachel Byrne. And you're Francis' daughter.
Yeah. I mean, you never know when someone is obviously going to die, or, you know, the hour and that. So, like, we'd been ringing them up and asking, you know, how he was, had he deteriorated. So he was bad that particular day. And so we went up that evening, or that kind of afternoon. Obviously, we were allowed in. We had to put on all the PPE, so the big blue gown, the gloves, the mask, I think the goggles. And we kind of only had just about kind of got it all on. And the nurse was kind of like, you know, you can come in, and kind of rushed us in. And like, it all kind of happened really quickly in the moment. And he was kind of gone within about maybe a minute or so. Like, it just kind of happened very quickly. It's all a bit of a blur, obviously, because we were kind of just kind of thrown in one sense. And then it was kind of like, what's happening? My dad didn't look great. Obviously, it's not a pleasant experience to kind of see that kind of situation. I hadn't really experienced much in terms of people dying. So it's not necessarily a pleasant memory, just that particular one. But then it kind of was all over. We didn't really know what the protocols were, because like with COVID, everything was so different.
And do you think he knew that you were there in that last minute? Do you think he knew that you were with him?
He did open his eyes and kind of looked at myself and my mom. Whether he knew kind of who we were as such, because obviously we had all the PPE on, I can't say. But I think he knew that at least someone was there. And I hope that he knew that it was us. Like who else kind of would it be?
And I suppose how important was it for you to be there in that moment? I know a lot of families didn't get the chance to have that. Yeah.
No, it was really important. I think particularly more for him. As I said, it obviously wasn't the most pleasant experience of my life. Obviously, it wouldn't be. But I think for the person that is dying, I think it is really important, at least from my perspective, that they're not on their own. And as you said, obviously not everybody gets that experience or could with COVID, with the restriction. And we just happened to be kind of lucky in terms of, as I said, you don't know when someone's kind of going to die. So we were just lucky that we were there at that time. It was more like a fluke as opposed to, obviously it's not planned.
And tell us about your dad. What was he like? Give us an insight into the person he was.
So I'm an only child. So, I mean, he was a great father all growing up. He was always there for me. He was really, really reliable. If, you know, like when I was a kid, you know, and you want to be dropped here, there and everywhere to friends' houses, he'd always be there and he was always on time. I knew if I said, Dad, I need to be somewhere at 6 o'clock, he was always ready and always early. He'd always give out to me if I was late, but very incredibly punctual. He was in Roadstone in Belgrade for 44 years, so very hardworking man. He worked all the hours that God gave him, just, you know, like Monday to Friday and Saturdays as well, just worked to kind of give me the life that he wanted to give me, to put me through education. So like I couldn't have asked for a better dad or a better mom.
And you're doing a PhD in science now.
Yeah.
So proud of you.
So yeah, of course. And obviously I did my undergrad in biochemistry and he was at my graduation for that. So that's obviously a great memory. My dad never went to college. He never did his leaving cert. So I think, you know, he really pushed kind of education. I was always kind of someone who liked kind of studying and that sort of thing. So I think he was super proud of me. And then I did a master's in Edinburgh and he came over for that graduation, him and my mom. So that was another kind of really proud experience. So hopefully I'll graduate or I'll finish my PhD hopefully next year, and then the graduation might be a year later. So in one sense, I'm looking forward to that. But obviously I have the photos of my other two graduations and he obviously won't be there. So that's kind of, you know, upsetting. But it is what it is, so.
Even though there was an age gap between myself and Francis of about 7 years, like as you got older, like he became your big brother and you kind of looked up to him. And my memories of Francis growing up was always music and the garden. Francis would be in the garden all day. I think that's where I got my green fingers, was from Francis, because you'd be copying what he was doing. And he was a fanatic for Elvis Presley. He was mad into Elvis Presley. He eventually, when he got married, he took his wife and his daughter over to Graceland. He was an Elvis fanatic.
He was a great father all growing up. He was always there for me. He was really, really reliable, very hardworking man. He worked all the hours that God gave him to give me the life that he wanted to give me. I couldn't have asked for a better dad.
And your uncle spoke about that idea that COVID took an awful lot away from you guys in terms of how you were able to celebrate his life, say goodbye, all of those things.
Yeah, I think it's more just I missed the kind of... Dad would have known an awful lot of people. He's very involved in our estate, in the residence association, doing all the flowers, in the tidy towns. As I said, he worked in Roadstone for 44 years. So there was an awful lot of people who he would have known and who I wouldn't have known, but I would have liked to have met and kind of talked to them about my dad. You know, at a funeral, people always come up and they'd be like, oh, I remember when this happened, and you might get a funny story. And so I missed kind of not being able to kind of have that and kind of that kind of experience of just the kind of celebration of life of the person. Like we did get condolences on RIP.ie. We got some really nice messages from lots of different people, friends, family members, my old school principal, and some of them are really nice and some old, like some really nice stories, but it just wasn't the same.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Gus Nichols, director of Flanagan's Funeral Directors in Dublin. The pictures we saw from Italy around about the middle of March or slightly before the middle, and that shocked us, I think shocked a lot of people. And then we realised, well, when we saw the pictures of the Italian army effectively bringing the coffins to the cemeteries and joining a queue, we got worried. And we said, we have to stop that happening here, or not let that happen here. So we got a kickstart, we got a warning. And so we implemented, obviously, emergency meetings amongst ourselves and tried to buy and locate as much PPE as we possibly could. We instigate a training program for all the staff in terms of how they now are to deal with first call inquiries, and let alone people coming down and knocking on the door. And also from the practical point of view, our outdoor staff who would be going to nursing homes and hospitals where people were dying with COVID. So that was intense. It was quite intense. We had some very early morning training sessions, I remember, at the weekend in March, so we could keep the doors open, because obviously that's what happened in Italy. The funeral directors, the people who run funeral service in Italy, were sick and they couldn't provide the service. And that's why you saw the army. So whoever put that news report together probably helped a lot of people.
And when you think back to that time when you were watching those pictures, what were your thoughts and your feelings seeing those images coming from Italy?
I'll be honest with you, it was stone cold fear and some sleepless nights. We had no living memory of dealing with a pandemic, 102 years. You go back to our old records and we're around a long time. It's very hard to discern how they dealt with it practically, that huge increase in mortality. Interestingly, there had been some planning done in 2004-05 by the emergency flu, emergency planning department of the HSC, based on avian flu and SARS. So the state did have a dossier, and sensibly, the association, the Irish Association of Funeral Directors here, from almost the beginning, were reporting in or to NPHET as well. So it worked. That work done in the mid-noughties actually paid off in terms of keeping what we do going.
And prior to Italy, going back a bit further, maybe into January, when we were seeing the images coming from Wuhan, was that worrying to you at the time, or were you still feeling like it was quite far away?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And you'd heard of outbreaks before and SARS, and it never darkened the doors here, really. So I think, it didn't figure in our thinking at all. I think at first, probably early March was the first time we said, what about this thing?
You mentioned there an emergency meeting is called first. Just tell us about that meeting, the feeling, the atmosphere, what it was like.
Well, there was an invitation went out to the Dublin firms to meet and just discuss how we might manage it. And that was a good meeting. And it set down a few, I think, sensible plans about how we would do it. And then obviously each individual company had to adapt and work out how they were going to do it. And in our case, it was a training session, particularly for our staff that would be going to the nursing homes, how to wear PPE properly, how to take it off, how to interact with the staff when we get there. Because normally, if you're removing someone from a hospital mortuary and you know what you're doing, it takes about 10 to 15 minutes, if you know what you're doing. But in this case, with the whole PPE side of it, it could take over an hour and a half to do it properly and safely. So that required training. It required training for me and everybody, because none of us had done it. There was definitely an air of what's coming. Is this our world war, in a sense? It was ominous.
You didn't know what to expect?
No.
And I remember, to go back to the kind of early stages, I remember sitting in the government press centre in government buildings, and Liz Canavan from the Department of the Taoiseach talking about how they had acquired, you know, space for overspill mortuaries, and that these were precautions they were putting in place. And I remember sitting there and being utterly shocked by this one piece of a vast amount of information that was coming out that day. And obviously you will have been privy to that at the time as well. That was particularly shocking for people.
But the temporary facility was built, and it was staffed, and it was ready, and not one person, I don't think, had to use it. So that, for me, is a result for the country. A bit like the City West Hospital. I'm not sure how many cases went there. And the country had to do that. It had to do that if we got overwhelmed, because there was huge numbers and projections at one point, wasn't there, Sarah? There was, you know, excess mortality of multiples of what it actually was. And we just don't have the facilities or resources to deal with that. Obviously then, in terms of practice and meeting, you know, we are a service that meets people all the time, in their home or in a funeral home or whatever setting it is. We couldn't do that. So everything's by the phone, everything's on email. We didn't want people coming down to the funeral home and potentially carrying the virus and knocking us all out. So that was a hard thing to get your head around. And then when we did go to funerals, and whether they were COVID-related deaths or not, the distancing part of it was a whole learning that I had to do on the spot. And in many ways, I kind of felt we had to go through the process that other businesses did later on in the year. And we did all that in March.
It was kind of an emergency transition for you guys.
It felt like that.
Yeah. And even in your business, as you mentioned, like, comforting people is part of what you do. It's part of your role. Shaking hands with people, reassuring them. You weren't able to do any of that. All of that had changed for you in an instant.
Yeah. Do you know what, though? Families were amazing. They really, you know, they really got it. They didn't like it, but they got it. And they really stood up. My word, certainly at the beginning, to be told you couldn't attend your husband's funeral. Wow. Because you were potentially a carrier or had it. And I really think, whilst everyone has been rightly praising the health service, I think families who lost people were amazing in this country. Amazing.
And you saw that devastation firsthand. You were literally on the front line as they were either getting to say goodbye or, on the other hand, not, maybe through video, different channels. What was it like to see that and to witness firsthand the grief that people were experiencing?
Well, it started, I just felt really weird. And then it sort of set in a little bit that you got this actually really, really sad. And we try and do drive-bys, you know, past, go down the road, and maybe the neighbours would come out, or the wife would come out, you know, with the mask on. It was like a movie. A lot of people forego what they would have normally had wanted or expected. It might have gone direct to the crematorium or direct to the gravesite. Don't forget, a lot of clergy are over 70. So they were really struggling with having, you know, they couldn't go in many cases. They had to be careful. So funerals really became very quiet, sanitized, low-key, not Irish events, when you think about it.
And do you think that changed also as a society, as how we say goodbye to people? There's such an emphasis in there, in our fibre, in our being, of how we say goodbye to people. Yeah. And all of a sudden we had to do the complete opposite to that.
I think we will return to normal life and the normal marking the moment of a death. I think we will, but not to the same extent. I think funerals are, in a lot of cases, going to be inherently smaller events than we might have been used to. I think a good example might be a work colleague who loses somebody. In Ireland in 2019, you might well have taken an hour and a half off to go down to the church just to support them. I see that happening far less, even with vaccines and no more levels. I think funerals will change. I think more people are going to log online and watch them. They're going to leave a message of condolence on a website. Now, I could be wrong, and I think it's very sad, in a sense, that we're not there yet. If that was to disappear completely, I'm not making myself too clear, I think that would be a sorry thing.
You were then coming and going to work during those first couple of weeks where you're living in your new normal. People hate that term. What was it like for you? Were you just in a kind of a robotic work mode, just get on with it? Like, you probably didn't have time, perhaps, to think about it?
No, we didn't. And, my commute took about 6 minutes instead of 40 minutes. We were walking around. I was in the head office in Ainger Street quite a lot. I had the mask on. There was just us, a few locals, and the police. That was it. It was weird. I was obviously worried at the beginning about bringing infection back home. Genuinely, I think we all were. But touch wood, that did not happen.
I was going to say, because you and I were talking about that yesterday, and you were saying that there were some sacrifices on a personal level that people had to make to try and keep the business going and to keep being able to serve families in the communities.
I mean, one example of a colleague who always worked during the day, Monday to Friday, sometimes weekends, but daylight. And overnight, she switched to working nights and taking our night service phone. I thought that was an incredible commitment, just to change, turn your life life upside down like that. And she did it, and she was very happy to do it.
And so she was taking calls in the middle of the night for the families in distress then?
Yes.
It's reasonable that, you know, this is your line of work. You deal with death all of the time, so of course you're bound to be familiar with it. But even for you, being a professional person who deals with death all the time, was the impact of COVID-19 still quite shocking for someone like you?
Yeah, I think when you see over that six-week period of April and into May, an almost 50% increase in the number of funerals that were being conducted, that's a shock. Now, we're used to busy periods, and they tend to be the winter months, January, February, and we have almost like a built-in resilience to deal with a large number of calls at that time. But we were not quite expecting what we had to do in April. Taken as a whole, yes, is it a shock to the system? A system, it bloody well is.
COVID took the human connection that families have when they're grieving. It took that away. It showed no mercy. We were robbed of that grief, that connection, the hugging and the embracing each other as a family. That was taken from us. Even when Francis passed away, when Betty and Rachel came outside to the car park, like after her husband dying, we couldn't hug them. We were just staring at each other. We offered our condolences. But we just, you know, after your husband passing away, my brother passed away, just four people out in the car park just ended up just turning their backs and going home.
And how's your mom doing now? How's she coping?
I mean, in one sense, because of COVID and because we were in the kind of lockdown, at least I was at home. So like she wasn't kind of on her own. So it was kind of a new kind of experience. But I mean, we're trying to do the best we can and trying to, you know, ring the family. Mom has a big family as well, so like lots of her siblings will ring her up and ask her how she is. We've got great neighbours, and they're always looking out for us. So I mean, we're just trying to get on with it and kind of live life in this kind of new normal.
Yeah. And finally, how would you like your dad to be remembered? If, you know, what's the one thing that stands out that you'd like your dad to be remembered for?
I think just the amazing person he was, the amazing father, the community man he was, that he just gave up so much of his time for other people, and he just gave myself and my mom a great life. Like he was the one who he worked so hard. Like my mom kind of, she reared me, but dad, like he put the money on the table. And he gave me everything that I wanted. Like we went on holidays every year, so that was obviously, I was lucky to do that. He was so supportive of my education. And he was a great man of faith as well. So, you know, that kind of inspires me too. And yeah, he's just a great man. So I hope that I'm half the person he was.
I reckon he'd be very proud of you actually.
Thank you. Yeah.
That was lovely, thank you. Great.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.